Welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 522 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the series on the 2024 Step 2 CK Free 120. This is going to be part 5. We've done the first 30 questions in the series. Again, it's a super educational series. So I'll encourage you, if you missed the first 4 parts, go back and listen to it. Okay, so let's begin from question 31. A 2-year-old girl is brought to the office by her parents for a well child examination. She was adopted 2 months ago. She has no history of serious illness and receives no medications. Vital signs are within normal limits. Examination shows no abnormalities. After the examination, the parents ask when they should tell their daughter about the adoption. Which of the following is the most appropriate advice regarding the best time to tell the patient? Option A says after she turns 18 years of age. Option B says as early as possible, even if she cannot process the whole experience. Option C says once the seal on the adoption records has been lifted. Option D says right before she is enrolled in kindergarten. Option E says when she learns that she is not biologically related to her parents. Now, this is an example of a kind of question that you pretty much cannot prepare for. It's one of those things where you have to make judgment calls on your exams. But the thing is, when you see situations like this, the first thing you want to do is get rid of answers that make no sense, right? So like option E doesn't make any sense. Or when she learns that she's not biologically related, that's pretty ridiculous. So we're going to get rid of that. Option C says once the seal on the adoption records has been lifted, doesn't make sense. There are just certain things where if you've taken enough exams, MBME-based exams, you know that, yeah, these answers don't make any sense. So option C and E, we're not going to worry about those. So we're kind of stuck between A, B, and D. A says after she turns 18. B says as early as possible. D says right before she's enrolled in kindergarten. So the thing is, looking at questions like this, let's just ask ourselves, which one seems to make the most logical sense? Do you think it's better logically to wait till a child is really old before you tell them they're adopted, or would you want them to know early? Well, I would say I would probably want them to know early. So personally, I'm going to go with option option B in this case. The thing is, you may wonder, like, man, is this a USMLE concept? But I remember when I was, I think, studying for step one back in the day, I learned that children have understanding of things like death. Even if they're young, you know, they do understand, especially at certain early ages, that, see, this person may not, this person is never coming back again kind of deal. And again, just in my own personal experience, I just know that you may think that children don't know anything, but they actually know things. They can really pick up on many things very early in life. So I would say for this, option B makes the most sense. I'm not going to go with option A after she turns 18. That's pretty late, right? The child is probably going to feel pretty betrayed that, wow, I've gone through all of life and you've not told me this. Because the thing is, children can adjust to things the earlier you teach them something. I always think of this Bible verse that says, train up a child in the way you should go. When he grows up, he will not depart from it. So it sounds like that training should have come before the child grows up. So honestly, for me, I don't know how I can really connect this to any concept, but just logical reasoning, I'll go with B. Because I'm just asking myself, between option B and option D, option B just makes better sense. Option D says right before she's enrolled in kindergarten. There's nothing special about kindergarten that will affect anything. So I'm going to go with option B here. All right, let's continue. A surgical intensive care unit observes that the number of days that patients have central venous catheters in place and the number of bloodstream infections have been increasing. A multidisciplinary team from the unit would like to decrease the number of days that central venous catheters, those are central lines, are in place in order to improve performance in this area. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step? So option A says, ask clinical providers in the unit to identify what they believe to be the most common factors leading to non-removal of central venous catheters. Option B says, change all central venous catheters every 5 days. Option C says, place stickers on all intensive care unit doors, reminding staff to reassess the need for a central line. Option D says, plan a randomized control trial to test the effects of a reminder to reassess the need for a central line on a daily goals sheet implemented during rounds. So what do you think is going on here? This is a classic healthcare systems question. And honestly, when people see questions like this, one principle that's honestly very helpful is just doing things in order. That's one thing I've figured out with many USMLE questions. Just do things in order. Do things in order. Like, they know they have a problem. The number of days central venous catheters are in place is going up. The number of central line associated bloodstream infections is going up. Okay, we want to decrease the number of days that people on CVCs and want to decrease the number of infections. Well, before you start doing any of those things, it probably makes sense to figure out, why are we having these problems? That seems like the right first thing to do. And then after you figure out why you're having the problem, you then go ahead and create a plan for solving that problem. You then pretty much execute that plan. And then you reassess and see, okay, how's this plan doing? So it just seems like a smart thing to do. Seems like a simple PDSA cycle kind of deal, right? Plan, do, study, act. So honestly, we don't know what's causing the problem. So let's figure out what's causing the problem. So option A makes the most sense, right? Option B, you start fixing a problem you don't fully understand. Doesn't make any sense. Option C, you start fixing a problem you don't fully understand. Doesn't make sense. Option D, you start fixing a problem. The randomized control trial is to kind of a way to figure out, but like, you don't have to do a, in fact, you don't have to do a randomized control trial when you can just ask, right? Start with a, maybe you want to do a randomized control trial later, but like, it doesn't really make much of any sense. And honestly, a randomized control trial is going to have like an experimental group and a control group. Option D doesn't really seem to spell out much of a control group. I don't know how you're going to be able to do a randomized control trial without a control group. So option A just makes the most sense. Option A just makes the most sense, right? So I know you may be like, wow, Divine, throw out the buzzword PDSA. But honestly, most of these things are conceptual. It's like a classic rule of healthcare systems and quality improvement and whatnot. Understand the problem first. After understanding the problem, collecting data, making metrics, make a plan. After that, execute said plan. After that, reassess. If it's a good plan you had in the first place, keep doing what you're doing. That's it. That's like a classic mantra. So even if I did not know PDSA cycle or whatever, this is a simple question that one could easily have answered. All right, let's go to question 33. A 17-year-old girl comes to the office because of a 3-month history of daily moderate epigastric pain that is more severe after meals. So epigastric pain 3 months kind of tells you something. 3 weeks ago, she had watery diarrhea for 2 days, which resolved spontaneously. She has not had vomiting. She has no history of serious illness and takes no medications. Vital signs are within normal limits. Examination, including abdominal examination, shows no abnormalities. Which of the following is most likely to confirm the diagnosis? Option A says CT scan of the abdomen. Option B says endoscopy. Option C says examination of the stool for ovarian parasites. Option D says stool culture. Option E says upper gastrointestinal series. Okay, so let's look at this question, right? So we see a person having chronic epigastric pain, more severe after meals, right? After you eat a meal, your stomach is going to secrete a lot of gastric acid. So it kind of tells you something. And the location of the pain, epigastric, right? That's kind of stomach, pancreas area. This girl is not an alcoholic. It's not pancreatitis. This is a stomach issue. It's probably peptic ulcer disease. Well, we know that peptic ulcer disease, most common cause is going to be H. pylori. So now we just need to find the answer that is will help us evaluate the stomach to detect H. pylori. Option A doesn't make any sense, right? CT scan of the abdomen. You can see H. pylori on a CT scan. Option C says examination of the stool for ovarian parasites. If you're thinking of H. pylori, we should not be looking at the stool for ovarian parasites. H. pylori is not really a parasite. It's more of a bacteria. Option D says stool culture. Again, doesn't seem like a wise idea. Option E says upper GI series. That's wrong. That's the answer you would select when you're dealing with bilious MSS in a newborn. So like duodenal atresia, jejunal atresia, malrotation. That's not the answer here. The answer here is B, endoscopy. Again, the thing is, if the USMLE is put esophagogastroduodenoscopy, EGD as an answer, everyone will get it right. But again, they clearly did not do that. Again, the USMLEs these days, they're very big on not putting straight answers. They like to put answers that are kind of related, but not exactly what you're expecting. So again, make sure, just throwing out this warning again, make sure another person is just memorizing. Make sure you actually understand what's going on, right? So you can do an EGD, do a biopsy, and detect H. pylori. Remember, H. pylori is treated with triple therapy, right? Clarithromycin, amoxicillin, and a PPI. Or you can do quadruple therapy with metronidazole, bismuth, tetracycline, and a PPI. So just something to keep in mind. All right, let's go to question 34. So a 23-year-old man comes to the emergency department because of a one-hour history of intermittent coughing spasms that began suddenly while he was attempting to clean mold from his garage with a mixture of acetic acid and cleaning agents. The cough is not productive. He reports shortness of breath only during the coughing spasms. Medical history is unremarkable and he takes no medications. Young person, wheezing and all those things. You probably know what's going on here. He does not smoke cigarettes, drink alcoholic beverages, or use other substances. He's 180 centimeters, that's 5'11" tall, and weighs 75 kilograms, that's 165 pounds. His BMI is 23 kilograms per meter squared. Vital signs are within normal limits. Pulse oximetry on room air shows an oxygen saturation of 94%. The patient has periodic paroxysmal coughing during the examination, or pharynx is clear. Auscultation of the lungs discloses bilateral wheezes throughout all lung fields. There is no use of accessory muscles of respiration. The remainder of the physical examination discloses no abnormalities. Chest x-ray shows mild hyperexpansion of the lungs bilaterally. Results of arterial blood gas analysis on room air are shown below. So the PO2 is 72 millimeters of mercury. The PCO2 is 38 millimeters of mercury. The pH is 7.41. And the bicarb is 23. Which of the following is the most appropriate initial step in management? Option A says albuterol therapy. Option B says bronchoscopy. Option C says CT scan of the chest. Option D says intubation. Option E says methylprednisolone therapy. So this person clearly has an asthma exacerbation. It's pretty straightforward. So when a person has an asthma exacerbation, what's the first thing you start with? You want to start with nebulizers to open up the airway. You can use albuterol, which is a short-acting beta-2 agonist. You can also give ipratropium, which is a short-acting muscarinic antagonist. Many times people get both. So I'm going to go with option A here. Remember, after that, within the first hour of the person, you know, being diagnosed or whatever, getting to the hospital, you want to give IV steroids. You can give like IV dexamethasone and stuff like that. Usually for most people, that's fine. Now, if that's not working, then you need to start considering other measures like magnesium. It's actually pretty helpful, has a pretty low number needed to treat in people that have asthma exacerbations. You see how I just kind of threw in low number needed to treat. That means that if intervention is pretty effective. Again, it's just one of these things that the USMLEs love to do. Take a concept and just integrate it away somewhere. I mean, who would be expecting a biostats question out of an asthma exacerbation question? Again, it's just a classic thing the USMLEs do. They can give you a biostats question where a person has like an asthma exacerbation or something. And then they give you a randomized control trial, give you a bunch of number needed to treat. And then they ask you which one will be the most effective intervention for this person. You should probably pick the one that has the lowest number needed to treat. I'll let you make that simmer in your mind for a bit. But it's just kind of important to be able to make integrations. And make sure you can see things in different ways. That's like a very simple question that many people will get wrong. Many people will waste so much time on. But it's actually a pretty simple concept. Because obviously, if you have a low number needed to treat, chances are that thing is pretty effective. If you have a high number needed to treat, that means very few people get clinical benefit from that intervention, right? So, you know, those are just things to kind of keep at the back of your mind for exams. Remember also, you can do CPAP, BiPAP, you know, non-invasive positive pressure ventilation in asthma if all these interventions are not working. But if you notice a person that has asthma, an asthma exacerbation, and their CO2 was normal, at, you know, was because usually when people have an asthma exacerbation, their PaCO2 is low because they're hyperventilating. If you notice that it starts normalizing or it starts rising, that's a bad sign. It tells you that the person's respiratory muscles are getting tired. Those people need intubation as quickly as possible. If not, they're probably going to die. So you don't want that. So it's something to keep in mind. You know, in ICU circles, you may also hear of heliox, like helium. It increases like laminar flow in a person's airway. That's something that could be talked about in the future if we have the time for it. But they probably won't go that far on the exam. So I'm going to go with option A. Option E is, you know, given IV steroids, something should do after you've given the nebulizers. Nebulizers will act immediately and start helping the person. Steroids are going to take a while to kick in. Okay. The person doesn't need intubation. You've literally tried nothing. And the person seems to be pretty with it, right? So we're not going to be intubating. CT scan of the chest, that's for like a PE or whatever, or pneumonia. Don't do that. Bronchoscopy is pretty ridiculous. Okay, let's go to question 35. So an 87-year-old man is admitted to the hospital because of a 4D history of moderate abdominal cramps, nausea, and vomiting. He has not had a bowel movement or past gas in the past 24 hours. He has colon cancer metastatic to the lungs, liver, and peritoneum. 18 months ago, he underwent a low anterior resection for T3N2 rectal cancer. I know some people may see this and say, oh, Divine, do I need to memorize staging of... No, just don't. Okay, moving on. 6 months ago, exploratory laparotomy showed diffuse carcinomatosis and bowel obstruction, and an iliotransverse bypass was performed. The patient and his family were informed of the findings and advised that he would not be a candidate for a laparotomy in the future, because there would be no surgical options to treat another obstruction. The patient has no other history of serious illness. Medications are 5-fluorouracil and bevacizumab, 5-FU, that's a thymidylate synthase inhibitor. Bevacizumab is a VEGF inhibitor. Temperature is 37.2 degrees Celsius, that's 99.0 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 100 per minute, respirations are 20 per minute, and blood pressure is 130 over 80 millimeters of mercury. The abdomen is distended and mildly tender to palpation. There are no peritoneal signs. CT scan of the abdomen shows a mild jejunal, small bowel obstruction, multiple intraperitoneal tumor deposits, and ascites. The physician recommends insertion of nasogastric and percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy tubes. The patient and his family request that the patient undergo a laparotomy and intestinal bypass. Which of the following is the patient's family request the patient undergo a laparotomy and intestinal bypass? Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? This is a classic ethics question. You're clearly told in the question that, hey, we're going to do this procedure for you now, but if you have any future cases like these, there's nothing where we're not going to be able to do a laparotomy. Okay, so basically the USMLE in this question has told you the medical guideline. They've said, hey, can't get a laparotomy now. And the family's like, hey, we want a laparotomy. So you're going to be like, hey, we talked about this back in the day. We cannot do this. I'm sorry for your grandpa or whatever that's not feeling well, but we just cannot do it. Right? Basically, with ethics questions, if something does not meet medical guidelines, don't pick that answer. It's not going to be a good choice. So let's see the answer that basically makes us not to do what the family is requesting. So option A says, abide by the wishes of the patient and the family. That's wrong. Option B says, alter the chemo regimen. That's wrong. Option C says, explain the futility of the operation to the patient and his family. Sounds like a really good answer. I'm going to go with option C, but let's look at the others. Option D says, offer to transfer the patient to another facility. No, try to talk things over to people first if you can. Option E says, suggest external beam radiation therapy. No, that's wrong. So the answer is going to be C. Simple as that. No overthinking needed there. Now, question 36. A 62-year-old woman comes to the office because of a 3-month history of anxiety, insomnia, and frequent bowel movements. She has had a 9-kilogram, that's a 20-pound weight loss during this period. Pulse is 90 per minute and irregular. All right. Respirations are 22 per minute and blood pressure is 150 over 65 millimeters of mercury. She's restless. The thyroid gland is diffusely enlarged. A bruise is heard over the thyroid. Examination shows pulmonary erythema. Some of her fingernails are separated from the nail beds. There's widening of the peripheral fissures, of the palpebral fissures, and thickening of the skin over the dorsum of the feet with a peau d'orange appearance. Peau d'orange doesn't always mean inflammatory breast cancer, as you can clearly see here. There's a fine tremor. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? Right. So let's look at this. Option A says Addison's disease. Option B says carcinoid syndrome. Option C says Cushing syndrome. Option D says pheochromocytoma. Option E says thyrotoxicosis. Let's look at these answers one by one. Option E says Addison's disease. Addison's disease, these people are going to be pretty hypotensive because they have like an aldosterone deficiency and a cortisol deficiency. They'll be hypotensive. They'll have skin hyperpigmentation because they're not making cortisol. So there's no negative feedback. So their ACTH shoots up. Remember, whenever your ACTH shoots up, your MSH, melanocyte stimulating hormone, is going to shoot up as well because both of them come from the compound POMC. The person is going to have skin hyperpigmentation. They'll have all these electrolyte abnormalities, like, again, all from aldosterone deficiency, like hyponatremia, hyperkalemia, normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. Literally, look at all I've said about Addison's disease. It's not here in this question. Option A is wrong. Option B says carcinoid syndrome. Remember, carcinoid syndrome, you're going to see bronchospasm, you're going to see flushing, you're going to see diarrhea, you're going to see right-sided heart problems, especially when it's metastasized to the liver. Again, the only thing we see here is diarrhea. But pretty much every other thing about carcinoid is not here. It doesn't make any sense to pick carcinoid. We're going to get rid of that. Option C says Cushing syndrome. You're going to see a person that is obese, a person that has buffalo hump, moon faces, and whatnot. We don't see that here. We're not going to pick that. Pheochromocytoma. These people's symptoms tend to be episodic, right? Episodic headache, hypertension. One person has hypertension, but again, we don't even see like any MEN association here, like MEN2A or 2B. We just don't see any of that. So that's wrong. So I'm going to go to option E here. This person probably has Graves' disease. Remember, Graves' disease is the most common cause of hyperthyroidism in the US. But this person has thyrotoxicosis. We can see many pieces of evidence here, right? Like, our friends at the MBMEs, they like to occasionally test the hyperthyroidism as anxiety. Because if you have a lot of thyroid hormone, you're going to feel like an anxious person. Frequent bowel movements, that's common in people that have hyperthyroidism. Weight loss, because your basal metabolic rate is going to increase, right? When your basal metabolic rate increases, you're going to be burning up a lot of calories. You're going to lose weight. This person has AFib. Irregular rhythm. Remember, the most common arrhythmia, that's actually pretty high yield. The most common arrhythmia in people that have hyperthyroidism is AFib. So this person's got AFib. You can hear brewery over the thyroid. Thyroid is diffusely enlarged. This is probably Graves' disease. Pulmonary erythema, you know, fingernails lifting off the nail bed. Those are, again, all pretty common findings in people that have Graves' disease. So this person has Graves' disease. So we're going to treat the person for Graves' disease. Remember, the T3, T4 will be high. The TSH will be low. And this person should get PTU or methimazole. Probably get methimazole since they're not pregnant. PTU is something we love to use in the first trimester. Although you can also use it throughout pregnancy, it's not a big deal. And PTU is something we use in hyperthyroid, like a thyroid storm, because it inhibits the peripheral 5' deiodinase that converts T4 to T3. So we can use PTU, we can use methimazole, but this person should probably get definitive treatment with I-131 therapy. So seems like the best thing to do. So option E is the right answer here, though. Okay, let's go to question 37. Oh, it's a HPI question. Again, for these questions, people kind of sweat over them. You should probably do them on your second pass through a block. But honestly, most times just gloss over it. Many times it tends to be on the easier end of the spectrum. So this is a guy that's 28 years old. He's coming to the clinic. So it's probably nothing emergent. And this person was coming for follow-up after colonoscopy showed up. Because of a 3-month, after undergoing colonoscopy, because he had a 3-month history of hematochezia, iron deficiency, anemia. So like pooping blood, well, that's not good. A young person is probably one of these IBDs, but let's keep going. So he has a 3-month history of 3 loose bowel movements daily. Okay, so chronic diarrhea. I really like IBD a lot. No fever, abdominal pain since colonoscopy, no bright red blood per rectum. Reports no new symptoms today. Past history GAD is on citalopram, that's an SSRI for his GAD, no allergies, mother and father are fine. He has smoked, it's not a good idea. I mean, you're a young person, you're 28, you've already smoked for 10 years. So he already has a 20-pack year history at 28. Sounds like COPD is in this person's future. Okay, let's look at the vitals. Again, you're just looking out for anything that really stands out and is really bad, right? So, The vitals, nothing crazy stands out. Now the abdomen, scaphoid, normal active bowel sounds, liver span is 9 centimeters by percussion, mild tenderness to palpation of the right lower quadrant without rebound or guarding, right? That's like the terminal ileum area, right? This is an IBD. No hepatosplenomegaly. Diagnostic studies, so colonoscopy, areas of coalesced ulcers with normal appearing mucosa between involving the ileum. Yeah, that's definitely a IBD. What kind of IBD does this person have? This is Crohn's disease, right? See skip lesions. Like literally they're describing, again, the USMLEs are not going to come out and say colonoscopy shows skip lesions. That's ridiculous. No. If they did that, everyone would get a 270 on their exam. No, they don't do that. Again, they're very descriptive these days, right? So what do they do? Oh, areas of coalesced ulcers with normal appearing mucosa between involving the ileum. Basically, with that sentence, they're telling you this patient has Crohn's disease. All right. So now let's answer the question. So which of the following is the most appropriate recommendation for this patient considering his condition? Option A says annual screening for lymphoproliferative disorders. Option B says discontinuation of citalopram therapy. Option C says prophylactic colectomy. Option D says smoking cessation. All right. So let's look at the answers. Annual screening for lymphoproliferative disorders. That doesn't really make any sense. People that have Crohn's disease, the big screening that's done in them is about 8 to 10 years after they're diagnosed with Crohn's, they should be getting colonoscopies every 1 to 5 years because they have an elevated risk of colon cancer. Same thing applies for ulcerative colitis, although remember the rule is kind of different. If you have PSC, if you have primary sclerosing cholangitis, then you're going to start getting screened for colorectal cancer literally right after you've been diagnosed with primary sclerosing cholangitis. So I'm not going to pick option A. Option B says discontinuation of citalopram. It's an SSRI for his anxiety. What are we going to be doing for his anxiety if we stop his SSRI? That's wrong. Option C says prophylactic colectomy. That's something we'll do for ulcerative colitis, okay? Not for Crohn's disease. Because remember, ulcerative colitis, look at the name, ulcerative colitis. It kind of sticks to the colon. So it's the colon's going to mess up. So to reduce these people's risk of colorectal cancer, people have ulcerative colitis, we can do a prophylactic colectomy. But this person does not have UC. UC does not cause skip lesions. It's Crohn's that causes skip lesions. So that's wrong. Option D says smoking cessation. I like that answer a lot because it's going to help his Crohn's, but it's also going to help him not get COPD and just die in the future from like the many other things that smoking causes in a person's life. So I'm going to go with option D. Remember, smoking actually worsens Crohn's disease, but people that start smoking, their UC tends to improve. That should not be used as carte blanche to tell a patient, oh, that has UC, keep smoking. But certainly if a person has ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, stopping smoking is actually a helpful thing to do. So don't forget that factor. It's kind of high yield to know for exams. Crohn's disease improves when you quit smoking. Ulcerative colitis improves when you smoke. Something to keep in mind. Okay. Now, a 19-year-old man is brought to the ED by ambulance 15 minutes after he was stabbed in the chest during a fight. The stab wound is located medially to the left nipple. At the scene, pulse was 105 per minute. Respirations were 18 per minute and blood pressure was 120 over 80. Pulse ox on room air showed an oxygen saturation of 96%. Two large bore intravenous catheters were placed on route to the ED and lactated Ringer solution was initiated. On arrival in the trauma bay, the patient develops a pulse of 130 per minute and blood pressure of 80 over 40 millimeters of mercury. There's JVD. Results of focused assessment with sonography for trauma, FAST, are most likely to lead to which of the following next steps for this patient. Option A says CT scan of the chest and abdomen with contrast. Option B says exploratory laparotomy. Option C says needle decompression and chest tube placement. Option D says pericardiocentesis. Option E says peritoneal lavage. All right, so what are we thinking about here? So let's look at these answers. So CT scan of the chest and abdomen with contrast. So CT scan of the chest and abdomen with contrast is something that's reasonable to do. Typically, after you do a FAST scan, a CT scan of the chest and abdomen with contrast just doesn't seem like a good idea in a person that is not stable. This person is definitely not stable. Person is tachycardic, they're super hypotensive, they've gotten fluids and they're still like that. Person has GVD. CT scan of the chest and abdomen with contrast doesn't seem like a good idea in a person that is that unstable. I'm not going to pick that answer. Option B says exploratory laparotomy. Well, I will think of exploratory laparotomy if a person has a peritoneal sign. You know, rebound, guarding, blah, 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 blah. Or stab injury to the abdomen. This question is talking about the chest, not the abdomen. I'm not going to pick option B at all. Option E says peritoneal lavage. Again, that's something you worry about if you're dealing with abdominal issues. This person was stabbed in the chest, not in the belly. I'm not going to worry about that. Option C and D are great answers. Option C, obviously, is what you're going to be picking if you're thinking of a tension pneumothorax. Option D is what you're going to be thinking if you're thinking of a pericardial effusion, you know, like basically a cardiac tamponade, So which one do we pick? Well, let's just go back to the question. If you go back to the question, then you can pick out the answer. Just ask yourself, where did they invest most efforts in? Like option C, I would pick option C if the question was talking about like, you know, decreased breath sounds, subcutaneous emphysema or something like that, although that's usually more with esophageal rupture, but decreased breath sounds and all those things. The question will focus a lot on the lungs. Option D, I'll pick option D if the person has like Beck's triad, you know, hypotension, GVD, muffled heart sounds. This person is definitely hypotensive. This person definitely has GVD. We don't see anything about the muffled heart sounds. But another thing is also, let's go back to step one. If you stab medially to your left nipple, remember your left nipple is your point of maximal impulse. It's like the, almost like the fifth intercostal space in the mid-clavicular line. That's your point of maximal impulse. That's where your left ventricle is. So if you were stabbed medially to the left nipple, chances are you probably stabbed the person's left ventricle. So there's just more stuff here that kind of goes with the heart. So I would go with option D here, pericardiocentesis. Yeah, it's kind of hard to differentiate that from option C, but I like option D better. If I were in an exam situation, that's a better idea. So I'm going to go with option D. All right. I'm pretty sure this person has cardiac tamponade because that's just the one we have information for. Okay. Question 39. A 47-year-old woman is scheduled to undergo right knee arthroscopy and partial medial meniscectomy. Medical history is otherwise unremarkable. At her pre-op examination 2 weeks ago, her surgeon discussed the risks and benefits of the procedure, and both parties signed the operative consent form. On the patient's arrival at the hospital, the paperwork is reviewed, she's taken into the operating room and sedated, and the anesthesiology team starts a spinal anesthetic. After the patient's right lower extremity is prepped for the procedure, a surgical pause is taken to review the patient's name and consent form, and to confirm the site of the surgery. The operating room team is unable to locate the consent form for review. No markings are present on the patient's extremities to indicate the site of the procedure. The surgeon says that he remembers reviewing the consent form with the patient and seeing her sign it. The patient's husband is in the waiting room. Which of the following is the most appropriate course of action? Option A says, ask the patient if she recalls signing the consent form, and if so, proceed with the operation. Option B says, ask the patient to sign a new consent form and proceed with the operation. Option C says, do not proceed and remove the patient from the operating room. Option D says, obtain verbal consent from the patient's husband before proceeding with the operation. Option E says, proceed with the operative procedure as planned. Okay, here's the thing. If you don't have a consent form, you cannot do non-emergent surgery. Simple as that. Is this emergent surgery? Will the person die if you don't do the surgery right now? No. So this is non-emergent. Okay. Do we have a consent form? We don't. Do we have something in writing? We don't. Should we do the surgery? No. Option C, move along. That's it. Option C is the best answer here. Right? If she recalls signing the form, if so, no, you don't have a physical evidence. Right? That's the thing. When you do things in haste, without complete information, that's how people get in trouble many times in life. Think of that as your life lesson for today. So that's wrong. right? Options B says, ask the patient to sign a new consent form. But again, usually you want to try to obtain consent under like non-stressful circumstances, if possible. Obviously, if it's emergent surgery, you got to get consent quick. But this is not emergent surgery. So option B, no, right? Because there are just so many things that can go wrong here. It's not just the consent, but like, okay, what side are we doing the surgery? You don't want to do wrong limb surgery. That would be bad, right? So option C, do not proceed and remove the patient from the operating room. Go and do work things out well. That's a better thing. Option D says verbal consent from the patient's husband. No, you should get it from the patient. If you can get a consent from the person that's getting the procedure, that's usually a better idea. Option E says proceed with the operative procedure as planned. Don't do that. That's not a smart idea. All right. You literally have no consent. Physical written evidence. Don't do that. Okay. Before we do question 40 again, I guess let's jump into question 40. Then I'll see a few things at the end. So 30-year-old man comes to the physician because he and his wife have been unable to conceive during the past 2 years. Previous evaluation of his wife showed no abnormalities. He has not been exposed to pesticides, heavy metals, radiation, or testicular overheating. Wow. The USMLEs and varicose cells. Testicular overheating. You may wonder, Divine, what do you mean by varicose cell with testicular overheating? That's actually a great way for our friends at the MBMEs to describe a varicose cell. Ouch. You think you've heard it all, and then you read a question and you're like, wow, these people are really getting up there. But remember, when you have a varicose cell, your pampiniform plexus is dilated. So it's not draining the testes well. So blood is going to hang around in the testes. When blood hangs around in the testes, it's going to basically make the testes at body temperature, which is not good. Because usually the testes, we try to keep it at 2 degrees below core body temperature. That's the optimal temperature for sperm production. So that's why the scrotum is outside the body. But if blood is kind of chilling in your testicle, that blood, remember, blood carries heat. It's going to keep that heat in your testicle. So sperm is not going to be produced. But and also, you know, people that sit on horseback and stuff, you know, all that pressure and stuff on the testicle is probably not very helpful for a person's reproductive potential. Okay, now physical examination shows no abnormalities. Serum studies show testosterone concentration within the lower reference range. A diagnosis of oligospermia is made. Which of the following is the most appropriate initial action by the physician? All right. Option A says, ask the patient about his alcohol intake, smoking, and stress level. Option B says, educate the patient about declining sperm counts with increased age. Option C says, prescribe a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. Option D says, provide a topical testosterone gel. Option E says, recommend in vitro fertilization. All right, so let's look at these answers. So this person has oligospermia. So oligospermia just means that, you know what, check a semen sample. There's not much sperm in it. Probably like under 15 million. I think that's like the cutoff. Under 15 million per mil. Under 15 million like sperm per mil of semen or something like that. So let's look at the answers. Let's start with option A. Ask the patient about his alcohol intake, smoking, and stress level. Alcoholism, smoking, and stress can kill a person's semen production. I mean, sperm production. So let's skip that for now. Option B says, educate the patient about declining sperm counts with increased age. This guy's 30. He should still have good reproductive potential. And honestly, that seems like not a good idea. Okay, remember that concept I said of figuring out what a problem is before you start fixing it. If a problem has not been figured out, you should probably try to figure it out before you start fixing it, right? So option B is like you're trying to fix what we've not figured out. Let's not do that. Option C says prescribe a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. This is probably like the answer that many people will pick that will be wrong. This person does not have erectile dysfunction. You got to figure out exactly what's going on. This person has oligospermia, not erectile dysfunction. We're not going to be giving them sildenafil for oligospermia. That's wrong. Option D says prescribe a topical testosterone gel. That's not a good idea. That's not a good idea, actually. You're going to be careful about that. Topical testosterone gel. You do that to people that have like low libido and whatnot. You can give people testosterone if they have a there are many formulations, I imagine, of testosterone, but people that have like low libido and stuff, and I don't know if a gel is the best way to accomplish that goal. I don't know much about that, so I'm not going to speak on what I don't know about. But this person doesn't have low libido. They just don't, are not making a lot of sperm. Option E says in vitro fertilization. No. Again, in vitro fertilization is something we do when there's infertility, usually from the female side of things. For the male side of things, like this guy that has oligospermia, the way you would likely fix the problem is doing an intrauterine insemination. So you pretty much like put semen in the uterus. That's not the same thing as IVF. IVF, you're literally doing stuff like in the lab. Something you want to kind of keep at the back of your mind. Again, read your questions carefully. And if you notice, like options B through E, we're trying to fix what we don't know about. We don't know what's going on first, right? Like, why does this person have oligospermia? Because if you can figure out the organic cause, then you can fix it better. So option A seems like trying to clarify what's going on. So I like option A a lot. All right. That's like a testing principle I've discussed now right there. So let's go ahead and stop there. This is more than 40 minutes already. But again, I have review courses that can help you many of these subjects. If you like the way I teach, the way I make integrations, the way I explain pathophase, you'll like the review courses I have. I have classes for step 1 to step 3 starting tomorrow. So that's Thursday, the 21st of March. So Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Thursday, we have the MBA Meat Test Taking Strategies course. It's 2.5 hours long. Friday, we have the 4-hour biostats class. It's Saturday, we have the social sciences, quality improvement, healthcare systems, and ethics class. All for step 1 to step 3. And then starting next week on Monday, on the 25th, we have the 20-hour step 2, step 3 class. Again, if you're expecting a lecture, you shouldn't come to the class. That's not what you're going to be getting. The classes are going to be, there's clinical situations, exam style questions and everything. And then I'll use those to show you how the material is presented, help you make integrations, help you understand pathophase. Again, many people have taken these courses and found them to be profoundly helpful. So if you're interested, they're all over Zoom. Shoot me an email through the website and give you some more information. And then I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and COMLEX exams. I have this podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. I have a YouTube channel where I make videos you can check out. I also help with the residency application process, rec letters, personal statements, and all those things. And then I also have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week I try to post 2 podcasts, usually about 10 minutes long, where from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that. It's called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. And the website, again, is divineinterventionlifelessons.com. So thank you for joining me today. I'll see you in episode 523. Have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. Bye for now. Thank you.